Welcome to the Texans Talk Podcast. I'm Mark Lang, Managing Editor of the Texans Wire, which you can find at texanswire.usatoday.com. Follow us on Twitter at The Texans Wire. Follow me on Twitter at The Real Mark Lane. And I'm always joined by John Crumpler, the lead analyst at the Texans Wire. How are you doing this week, John?
Mark, I'm doing very well. I mean, what a performance by the Houston Texans. I'm not feeling great, but I'm feeling pretty good compared to where we were a week ago.
Well, where can people tell you that they feel horrible and you should feel horrible on Twitter?
Oh, yeah. If you want to come tell me I'm too optimistic about the team, I'm too pessimistic about the team, you don't care what I think about the team. Always funny when you get one of those because it's like, hey, buddy, you're the one replying to me. You can follow me on Twitter at John H. Crumpler, trying to churn out a lot of content there.
Yeah, and we'll just go ahead and get started with that 2020 tie with the Indianapolis Colts. In looking at the national media, I haven't really seen it too much in the local media, but it's just like this is the worst thing in the world that has happened, that the Texans tied with the Colts and that Lovie Smith elected to punt on 4th-and-3 from the Colts 49-yard line with 26 seconds left. And it's 100% on the cowardly scale that I invented while in the drive-through line at Sonic waiting on my chicken nuggets. And, you know, so what do you make of it?
Mark, I knew you were a great statistician. I like that they went for the tie. And hear me, at first I was upset because, you know, you think with this young Texans team, either wins are fantastic because that's foundational and building towards the future, or losses are great because it improves your draft position. But I actually think that Lovie salvaged here an emotional, a great performance by the team. If you do go for it on 4th-and-3 and you don't get it, and all indications are that you're not going to get it. The offense has not been doing anything. Davis Mills' rhythm was off. The interior of the offensive line was getting bullied. Then you've squandered what was a really overall positive performance. Obviously, the execution wasn't there in the fourth quarter. There's some things that I know the team wishes that they'd done differently. But you throw that all away versus, I think, Lovie with this one said, I've got a lot more games to coach as the head coach in Houston. I want to walk away with a building block here. And he took the tie. And I think that's a big deal for this team in a game that, well, one, those guys beat them, I think, 62-3 combined last year. And they were a touchdown underdog. So to come out of there with a tie, hey, you played Indianapolis for 70 minutes dead even. I think that's a win for this team. So although, you know, from the analytics and from the outside perspective, I understand, hey, take the loss, you're a bad team, or go get the win. I see what Lovie is trying to do here, and it fits with the overall vision of this team. Did you feel the same way?
Well, that's why and this is really going meta at a certain level, think analytics are garbage. I said it. That's why I think all of this navel watching over numbers and graphs and everything at the end of the day is just detritus, because it takes away the human element, the emotional element, which is this, the IQ touched on. Not only do the Colts beat them 61-3 last year, for which Lovie Smith was the defensive coordinator that they put those 62 points on. Not only that, but think about Houston Texans history. What is it? It's where the Colts beat the Texans for the first 9 out of 10 matchups in franchise history. Houston doesn't even win in Indianapolis until 2015. And then everything in Houston Texans history has an element of the Colts always winning, always ruining the fun. Whether it's, like I said, winning the first 9 out of 10 matchups in the series history, whether it's not winning in Indianapolis until 2015, whether it's a Houston high school football product and Andrew Luck playing for the Colts and getting to the AFC championship game in 2014, whether it's them coming in to NRG Stadium in 2018 and beating the Texans and then going into Arrowhead Stadium, there's always an element of Indianapolis ruining it for the Texans. And I think that was what Lovie Smith knew, because when he took the job in Chicago, he said in his opening press conference, "We're going to beat the Green Bay Packers." And you know what? That's basically what he did. No one else has done a better job of beating the Packers since Lovie Smith, okay? And I think he understood that, which is that the Colts always win against the Texans. They always get their way. Well, not today, and they're going to go home disappointed, the same as us. There will be no winners. And look, you take a look at the power rankings and everything. Yeah, Houston gets dinged for it, but the Colts get dinged even worse for what happened in week one. So that's why I think acting like the tie's so bad is really a lot of hogwash.
Mark, that was beautiful. That was an excellent speech on the relationship between the Houston Texans and the Indianapolis Colts. And I
feel why do I have to say it, though? Why do I have to be the one? Like, you know what I mean? I'm not a Houston sports fan. I didn't grow up there or anything. Why do I have to be the one to figure it out? That's just what I don't get.
I mean, I think other people have echoed similar things, but I'm not sure it's been put as well as you just said it. But you've hit the nail on the head in that this is a franchise that has historically dominated Houston. They've played Big Brother since the franchise's conception in 2003. And this is a team that Houston was not supposed to be in the same on the same field as. They were at least a draft away, according to all the national analysts. And Lovie said, "I'm not throwing away all the good football we played off the bad football, the parts of the young team that started to shine through." And he gave them a building block. And you know what? Houston, I actually think they went up in the power rankings everywhere I looked this week. They were like 24 or 25. I didn't see any more 32s after this past week. But, you know, I did see a lot of Indianapolis coming down. And I think when you're going into another matchup, this time on the road against Denver, just having some positive things like, hey, that's an AFC playoff team and we played them to a tie. Why don't we do it again with Denver, a team that just underdelivered on Monday Night Football and is emotionally probably a little shot from that one? I do not hate the decision, and I understand it, even if the conventional wisdom would say there are no such things as moral victories in the NFL. I think this was a good one for
you. And to clarify, all of the analytics and stats and graphs and all that, they're not trash, but they are trash if that's all you go by. Same as if someone said, "Well, I got an eye for talent," twirling their whistle. You know, "Oh, yeah, I'm sure you got an eye for it." That's trash. That's all I'm saying is I don't like myopic visions of the game. I like taking in a comprehensive approach, and that's what I'm saying. So that's why I said in that context, analytics are trash. One stat that will always be trash is Damian Pierce's 11 carries for 33 yards against the Indianapolis Colts. The rookie who just shined in preseason had a paltry 3.0 yards per carry against the Indianapolis Colts. Some of it was due to diminished touches. So I got to ask you, John, are you disappointed in Damian Pierce after 1 week?
No, I don't really think that anything that happened to Pierce in this game was his fault. I think the coaching staff, and they've even admitted it this week, they were a little quick to pull the plug. Lovie had a quote today, and he talked about sometimes the game script sends you in a direction, and when you look back at it, you kind of regret going there. And I think this team knows, hey, we got to put Damian Pierce on the field more. You know, Pierce, to his credit, he's been a good soldier about it. He hasn't complained. He even went as far as to say he learned a lot watching Burkhead on the sideline. No, I can't be disappointed in Damian Pierce. I think this was going to be a hard team to run the ball against. It's a very well-disciplined defense with an incredible front seven. And he didn't really get the opportunity to get rolling. I think expectations are present, but it's not such that after one game I'm going to be upset with him. I think against Denver, I mean, it's another pretty good defense, but one that I mean, Rashad Penny in spurts had some good success watching a Monday Night Football. And I think Pierce is going to have a lot more of an opportunity and, you know, the verbal endorsement from the coaching staff to go off of. He is the starter and they need to treat him like one. Mark?
Yeah. And when you think about it, he was only out there for, in the first game, he was out there for, I don't know, a couple series, maybe a quarter. And then with the first team offense in the preseason finale, he was only out there for one series. And at every juncture, he wasn't going against a first-team defense. Now he's going against a first-team defense for an entire game. And it probably had an entirely different feel. And now that he's eased himself in, I think maybe he'll get some more touches. Now that he understands what his role is, what the pace of the game is like, and how to just keep yourself amped up throughout an entire four quarters. That's why I was surprised that he was the starter to begin with, is because when I look back at other running backs who have been successful in the NFL, they usually sit for maybe the first game, first four games. In other words, they take over the role just throughout the course of the season. It doesn't come to them all at once. Rarely does it just come to them all at once. And so that's why I was surprised. But, you know, I think that he will get it going at some point, and he will be RB1. Does it happen in Denver? It may not. But I still don't think that it won't happen this season.
I agree. I mean, this is his backfield, and the coaching staff has made that clear. He's going to be given the opportunity, but you're right. There's going to be a bit of an adjustment period here for Dameon Pierce. And this is a guy, forget adjusting to the NFL level. At the University of Florida, he was not a bell cow back. He probably hasn't been given this expectation that, like, hey, we really want you to be the lead guy since he played high school football. And so he's needing to adjust to the volume of the game, the speed of the game, just the overall endurance that's needed. And I agree with you that that's going to come at some point. It's just not going to come immediately. But the caveat, I'm not even going to put it on him adjusting as much as the coaching staff. You got to give your young guys some room to fail here. And I would like to see Dameon Pierce given a little room, even on passing downs. Like, you really think he's going to get Davis Mills killed if you leave him in there for a few passing downs to create at least the illusion that he's not going to run the ball? Because it's hard when the defense sees Dameon Pierce come on the field and they know that Burkhead's preferred for both passing and pass protection. All right, this is looking like it's going to be a run play. So if they want Pierce to turn into that multidimensional runner that I think that they drafted him with the hopes of him becoming and that everyone around the building expects him to be, they have to give him a chance.
Yeah, and the chance will come. I don't think that they're just going to Buddy Howell or Scotty Phillips him. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no. He's definitely not getting Scotty Phillips. He's already gotten a much better opportunity. Poor Scotty. Don't get me started on that one tonight, Mark.
How about Buddy Howell? I mean, here was a guy that was on the roster for 3 years, and he never saw any playing time until, like, I think it might have been garbage time against the Chicago Bears.
But did he ever?
2020.
But did he ever look as good as Scotty Phillips looked in the preseason of last year?
Nah, probably not.
Yeah. But that was an electric preseason. And, you know, it's hard to remember preseason. So when they're good, you know they were good. And I thought, it's fine. I'm not upset.
Yeah, I mean, somebody's got to compete with the Astros. So there's been a game. There's been 70 minutes of Houston Texans football this year. Have they done anything that has surprised you? Like something that you weren't expecting? And really what I mean is good. Did they do anything good that just kind of caught you off guard? with how they played against the Colts?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll start with the offensive side of the ball. The thing that I would point to is the schematic diversity and play calling of Pep Hamilton, I believed came as advertised. It was a run-focused offense that they preached, but they did it out of so many different formations, so many different ways. It was an offense that made life easier for Davis Mills and allowed him to really pass in rhythm, precision routes, the kind of things that we said this whole offseason that he would thrive the best under, which is structure and creating opportunities for his somewhat limited offensive weapons to go and get open. Pep did that, and he did it in such a way. I mean, the linebackers for Indianapolis really had no idea what they were doing at one point in the third quarter. They were getting sucked in on all the play action. It was creating these huge vacuums. I mean, that's how O.J. Howard scores two touchdowns, is the intermediate part of the field has been completely vacated, and this huge body, number 83, is there, and Mills is finding him. So I was really impressed with the play calling and just the diversity of the scheme. Not everything worked, but just how they went about trying to create offense was, I thought, a breath of fresh air. And then on defense, I'll say how they were able to pressure Matt Ryan. I was pleasantly surprised at how uncomfortable he looked for the game, especially for a veteran. I know he's on a new team there. He's on the road. But at the same time, Matt Ryan has played a lot of games in the NFL, and I thought Jerry Hughes and Jonathan Greenard played well. Hughes especially. I mean, who could have ever seen him getting the first sack and the first interception of Houston's year? He might be our best edge rusher right now. I was impressed with the D-line, and really until late in the game when the offense started to go three and out during that fourth quarter, the interior held their own too on Jonathan Taylor, making sure there weren't a lot of easy gaps. It was a tough day for Taylor having to run into the back of his own guys, getting gang tackled before things started to open up in that fourth. So I'd say the D-line. What were your big takeaways?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is the defensive line. To me, that was a surprise, because I know that there was so much talk about it, but I've heard a lot of talk when it's come to Tampa 2 defensive lines, and they usually don't – well, in my experience, they never manifested, particularly when they didn't have a war daddy the way that I don't think Houston does. Then you bring in Jerry Hughes and Mario Addison, and just like, well, you know, they're the old guys and they're old. And yeah. So I was surprised to see Jerry Hughes actually have something left in the tank. And I don't mean he just had like a TFL. I mean, he was disruptive. He really was. It was fascinating that he got two sacks, a forced fumble, an interception, which, you know, I think that was just veteran wisdom right there. The way he was able to peel away and get in the passing lane and just collect that screen pass. Mm-hmm. That's what the biggest surprise was for me. I didn't really have a surprise on offense. I think that everybody did exactly what I expected from a positive standpoint. The only negative that I would have, even though I said we weren't going to do this, the only negative on offense from, you know, that was a surprise, was just the timing with Davis Mills and his receivers. I thought the timing was going to be a little bit better, but that's something that will improve by October, because really these guys have not had a lot of live action reps together because of the nature of preseason. I mean, Brandon Cooks, he wasn't even out there the whole preseason. So
while we're on the topic of Mills, I was also not impressed / expecting a little better from some of those throws to the sideline, like the probably 12 to 20 yard, the beeline throws on curls, and they would just sail on him. I was surprised at how those balls just didn't look like he had a lot of control on them. He was missing high.
Yeah. And, you know, that, like I said, I mean, those are the things that surprised me. But as Houston moves to week two, taking on the Denver Broncos Sunday at 3:25, Central Time at Empower Field at Mile High. They'll be looking for their first full win because, hey, folks, the tie actually counts as a half win. So Houston is technically a half winner. They really are. They're 500 in the standings at 0-0-1. So it's really the Denver Broncos that are big losers. Anyway, so as they take on the Broncos, what problems do you think Denver is going to present?
I think the biggest problem that Denver presents is going to come just from who they are on offense and their personnel, that running back room. Houston, the weakness of the team, and this kind of revealed itself throughout the Indianapolis contest, is the front seven. We were surprised by the defensive line in a good way. That's because we expect the defensive line to be a weak unit this year. And I think Kamu Grugier-Hill and Christian Kirksey, despite the volume tackle statistics you're going to hear about, they're pretty average, probably below average starters at their position. And Javonte Williams and Melvin Gordon are not only tough to bring down, but they're one, Gordon's a veteran running back who knows how to run to get additional yardage. He's kind of there between the tackles, hard-nosed runner. I think Javonte is so explosive at finding angles, using his speed, his playmaking. I think they could give us fits potentially. And then whenever you're playing a veteran quarterback, obviously Russ did not look great in this past game, but this caliber of receiving group compared to what the Colts trotted out is a lot better, and Russ has a much more lively arm than Matt Ryan at this point. So I think slowing down that offense, especially they got embarrassed last week, so I expect to see a little more of an inspired Denver team. Originally, when we saw this game on the schedule, I was thinking Denver might have a bit of a hangover from blowing out Seattle, and maybe Russ isn't as focused because that was so emotional. But instead, he got embarrassed, and I think he's got to come out and prove that he's the guy the Broncos traded for. So that offense, but especially in the trenches, would be my biggest concern with the Broncos. What's something you're looking at, Mark?
Well, I think on defense, the pass rush for Denver could be problematic. If it's going to be the Davis Mills show again and the run game doesn't get going, then I think that would be an issue because he's more of a stationary quarterback. Not with a lot of, you know, mobility in terms of scrambling around. And so I think that he'd just be a sitting duck for the Broncos pass rush because you still got Bradley Chubb. You've got Randy Gregory. And they were able to cultivate at least one turnover with a fumble that they got against Seattle with Randy Gregory popping it out. And we already know that Davis Mills fumbled. I don't even think it was a fumble, to be honest, but okay. So, you know, he kind of has a susceptibility there. So that'd be my only issue that I think the Broncos could present. I think if it's an ugly game, maybe not an ugly game, but just more of a street fight, the way Monday night was with Seattle and Denver, I like Houston's chances in that type of game. If it's going to be an offensive showdown and Cortland Sutton, Jerry Jeudy, and Melvin Gordon get going, I don't know that Houston's going to have the same firepower to keep up. But if they can just drag them down to their level and it's a street fight, I think Houston has a chance.
And I mean, I think that's their recipe to win for this whole season is, can you force the other team to play really ugly football? And part of the reason the Colts game was so close, Alex Pierce, unforced errors, dropped a touchdown. Then Derek Stingley, the next time they're in the red zone, he makes a huge play. It's the little things are going to add up with this team because they need to close talent deficits. And I agree with you, it could be a problem with their defensive line against the Texans. But something that was a little encouraging is I thought Geno Smith actually navigated the pass rush that Denver deployed pretty well. And I would say Seattle, this is the best offensive line they've had in a few years. I thought they played a fine game, and Geno was able to show some getaway. And he's probably similar in the mobility scale to Davis Mills. But yes, Mark, if it gets to, if you got to score 30 plus points, the way, at least with what we saw from the first game and how it looks like Pep Hamilton wants to call and win games, this is not an offense designed to go score 30 plus. This is a, we need to be in close games because everything we do is predicated off the run. And if you have to just start passing like they had to in overtime, that's when we see Davis Mills take a sack against a three-man rush. So Denver is going to be interesting because it's not a game they should win, but last week was so ugly for the Broncos that I won't be surprised if it's very close from how disciplined the Texans play.
Yeah, I think that the thing with this team is if they can follow the game plan, which it seems like they did against the Colts, and they can just stick with the game plan, then I like where this team's going throughout the rest of the season because they're giving themselves a chance to win, and it shows discipline too.
Absolutely. They're well coached. I think they're a well-schemed team, but they're going to have to play perfectly, and that's a tough position to be in the NFL. This is it's a very watchable Texans season, Mark, because the talent, it's marginal, but there's enough there that they're going to hang around in most of their games this year. I really like the vision they're putting forward, and I'll be very excited a year from now after a free agency period and they add draft picks to see, hey, just how good can this team be?
Yeah, and one question that the Texans may have to face, and it's one that Denver had to face, is how do you get your franchise quarterback? Would you prefer, if you have a franchise, would you prefer the philosophy of drafting your way into a franchise quarterback or just saying, you know what, here's immense draft capital and we're going to sign the big contract and go get one that way?
I think all else equal, you always want to draft your franchise quarterback. And here's what I mean by that. With the new, I guess it's not new anymore, it's been around for a decade, but with the rookie contract scale in the NFL, it would be such an advantage if Houston does ultimately find their franchise quarterback through the draft, because it represents this 3, 4, heck, 5 years, if you really want to extend it out, window where you can invest more on the rest of your football team than anyone else can. As soon as they get off that rookie contract and you're trading for guys, look at what Denver had to pay Russell Wilson. Look at the unprecedented contract that Deshaun Watson got from the Browns. Like even Kyler Murray, who I think people would say is somewhere between the 9th and the 12th best quarterback in the NFL, he gets $240 million. So I would prefer the draft. You have to go through some growing pains. You're probably not ready to compete that first season the way that Denver probably feels they're ready to compete the first year of trading for Russ. But once you get through that growth stage, just what you're able to do and the caliber of talent that you surround your quarterback with, because Mark, it's a quarterback driven league, but you need talent to win it. Really good teams win the Super Bowls, not really great players. So I would want to be able to invest in that. And we've seen both strategies work, but I think there are some advantages that are built in when you can get it done with a young guy.
Yeah. I think the way to go is by drafting the quarterback and then loading up your roster with the cap space and just really realizing that you're kind of hitting a rebuild once you sign him to that extension. And that, to me, is when it you really have to be cap conscious and kind of soft rebuild and everything. Is once you hit that salary, I mean, that re-signing on that second contract. If you can get all the pieces now and then get your quarterback on a rookie contract, I mean, that's how the Chiefs did it. That's really how the Seattle Seahawks did it with Russell Wilson, too. You get rare situations like the Rams, where they just go trade and they get Matt Stafford, or you're the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and you luck into Tom Brady. But really, that, I mean, even the Eagles in 2017, although it was Nick Foles, it was Carson Wentz on a rookie contract that laid the foundation to get that number one overall seed in the NFC. So I think that's how you do it with even this collective bargaining agreement that they have now. I think that's how you have to do it, is to go get your rookie quarterback, on your franchise quarterback, on that rookie contract, and then load up the talent around him.
Yeah, I mean, I'll go to my Super Bowl prediction for the year. What are the teams that I picked? The Buffalo Bills, Josh Allen, I'm looking at it right here. His cap hit is just $16 million right now. That is so cheap. It's the cheapest it's ever going to be. And that's why Buffalo was able to go out and sign a player like Von Miller. You can add complementary pieces that you might not even need, but you can max out the talent on your team. And then from the NFC, like you talked about, I'm taking the Philadelphia Eagles. And a big part of what they've been able to do is Jalen Hurts is so cheap on that second round contract. They go trade for a guy like A.J. Brown. They go get Chauncey Gardner from the Saints. And they've got a mega stacked roster all of a sudden. I think if you have to pick, you always want the young guy. Plus, you know, years of contention afterwards.
And so that's what I'm saying is that's how I think a franchise should be built. And when you get a situation like that, and that's really the frustration with what Houston did from 2018 to 2020 is they had a franchise quarterback under rookie contract, and they went cheap and they got scared and were like, how are we going to pay the franchise quarterback's extension, and how are we, and then that's what you have to show for it is a wild card playoff win. That's all you have to show for all that.
Hey, that's part of why turning it to the present in some maybe happier terms, if Davis Mills becomes the franchise quarterback, it's going to be such a big deal for them because they're going to be spending not even 1% of the salary cap on the most important player on the team. And hopefully Nick Caserio saw what happened in Houston last time, and Lovie Smith knows the value of having a good quarterback and with the infrastructure you need to support him. Lovie Smith, he's been there. He's won before, and they go execute on that fully.
Yes, because when you build a roster, it's kind of like opening a buffet. And at the end of the day, the people want the prime rib. And if you're just going to have a buffet with vegetables and macaroni and cheese, even if it's the best macaroni and cheese, with bacon bits, and it's got that crust on it from just burning it just slightly in the oven, at the end of the day, people are going to be like, where is the prime rib? So that's why you've got to invest. You can't just have a buffet that has no prime rib. You've got to invest in that. And we'll see if Nick Caserio invests in that as he builds this buffet.
And I'm confident he knows the ingredients that he needs. And he'll go out and get it. He's not going to settle for a low cut of meat. He's going to go for the prime rib, Mark. And on that note, now that you've made your food comparison for the night, I'm going to tell the audience to make sure, Mark, that they have the Texans Wire set as their homepage. And that for you, my friend, they're pressing F4 and seeing all of the good stories we bring to the site. Guys, thank you for listening. Again, my name is John Crumpler. I'm the lead analyst of the Texans Wire. Make sure you're following me at John H. Crumpler. We're going to be bringing a lot of great content. Also with Sarge on the team. Mark, where can they find you?
At The Real Mark Lane on Twitter. You can find Sarge at Sarge. I'm sorry, at Big Sarge Sports with a Z. And yeah, follow the team.
Sarge has been a great addition. The quotes that he gets and the questions that he thinks to ask in the locker room are some of the best from guys on the beat. So make sure you're following him and our whole team. We're kind of stacked this year. All right, have a good morning, everyone.